So am I still waiting? Waiting a long time.
Waiting for tonight.
Listen to review, man.
But you know the Grails got the heart of a lion, and they all fight up and come back.
Whirly bird him around right there. Now they've been giving in and taking. Somebody got to go ahead and take it on.
Some
mission
now
with these two big guys, arms like tree trunks, chests as big as the Grand Canyon, and one of them got to submit.
Clubbern! That's Clubbern! Master Boys of Clubbern! The masters of Clubbern!
Come on in here, my little fried pie!
You can feel it, you can sense it.
You can smell it, too. And it smells like horror of war, brother.
Well, lordy daughty. Boola, boola, boola.
He's just a common man.
To review away, it's season five.
Season five, yeah.
Or is it season six?
Season five.
Season five,
yeah.
Is that right?
Yeah, that sounds right.
1 year in.
Wait a second. So it would be minus each one. Oh, it'd be season
six.
Six?
Because our first anniversary would be the end of the first year.
Yes. So this last one was the end of season five. Start of season six.
Season six.
Wow. Wait. That means like we could go into syndication pretty soon. We could get one of those lucrative, maybe the audio version of like a TBS Superstation that can pick up the classic episodes of Review Away, and we could get residuals.
Is that the rule? Those 5-6 years?
Usually 100 episodes is the magic number, and then you're into syndication heaven.
What is that? 6 years? Six seasons?
Well, it depends how many. We hit 100 episodes after 2 years.
Yeah, we did.
So we long since surpassed the 100 mark.
Syndicate.
Wouldn't that be great? We should have been doing podcast. A TV show this whole time. Fictional characters.
I don't think that would work.
A 30-minute comedy, you and I.
You're saying we should have invested our time into watching old wrestling.
We should have been doing a making of. We should have been filming us discussing what reviews we would do and make it a sitcom.
Oh, yeah, we totally had time.
You'd be the wacky Asian neighbor. Mm-hmm. I would be the nerdy white guy studying and dusting off his wrestling tapes stopwatch.
Yes, of course, you'd be the main character.
No.
I'm the neighbor. I'm the wacky token neighbor. Token minority neighbor.
Okay, you'd be the main character.
No, it's okay.
You could get us into more diverse communities.
Okay. Yeah, we can. But it would also mean maybe less people would watch.
I don't know about that. It would depend on where we got syndicated. You could bring us into different markets, I think.
Okay.
Way you're drinking a coffee, that means you're not having a great day.
No. It doesn't mean that. It just means I
feel like when you have coffee, it means you're mentally telling the world you've given up on the day.
No, not at all. I just kind of needed something to boost me, that's all.
You got the extra small coffee.
It's just a small coffee.
Look at the size.
You have what is known as a large.
A large.
Yeah.
Extra large.
Have you been seeing these videos that have been popping up online?
Yes.
Of people taking a large coffee and then pouring it into a cup of... an extra large cup from the same place. This was a Tim Hortons, for instance. Somebody took a large Tim Hortons cup, filled it up, and then poured it into an extra large Tim Hortons cup, and they've discovered that the large coffee happens to fill the extra large cup with the same amount of content.
Yes. I saw this other video of someone debunking this as a myth.
That's exactly what I was about to bring up. Oh. Tim Hortons, actually, themselves, I think they made it.
Yeah, maybe that's where I saw it.
And... you know, clearly showing that you get it's bullshit. Like, whoever made these videos just simply like wanted to start something. They probably put some stuff inside the cup beforehand into the extra large cup, and then, you know. But who would do that? What a jerk.
Capitalists would do it to save on their coffee.
To ruin a business like that, an honest business like the Tim Hortons.
I was, when I used to work at New York Fries and Pizza Hut. We had this manager who was like, you cannot, they were so obsessed with not over-serving people because you had to preserve every ounce of their food stock. It was just ridiculous.
Over-serve in what way?
Like you don't put – this is how big a scoop of cheese should be that you put on someone's poutine. And it should not be overflowing in any way. And we had this other woman. Her name was Vigi. And she would always be notorious for, like, watering down the gravy to such a disgusting degree.
Don't tell me this. I'm about to puke just thinking about it anyway. But I am curious. What is, like, some of the more disgusting stories you have about working at, what was it, New York Fries?
At New York Fries.
Oh, God.
There was one time when we got a shipment of the potatoes. And it was – I was in charge – we had the fry cutter where you would pull it and it would turn it into fries. Okay. And you had to, like, cut off any, like, bruises or marks on the potatoes.
Are these potatoes washed beforehand?
You wash them. You get them in a box, and then you'd wash them, and
were they washed well?
I always wash them thoroughly.
Okay, well, I trust you, at least.
I can't speak for everyone else, but mine were always immaculate. No one ever died on my watch. But this one potato, I cut it in half. And all these white things started swimming through the water.
Oh, no, my God.
And there were maggots. Maggots.
Feels like a China reveal.
God, it's just anything white seems to really turn you off.
No. That's terribly rude.
Yeah, little swimmers just to drive you nuts.
That's a very rude comparison for you to make, a very offensive comparison for you to make. But that is disgusting. That's gross. So
we had to throw them out. To throw them
out. Did any maggots happen to fall into any of the other fries?
No, they were isolated. I quarantined them.
Oh, that's so gross, man. It just gives me the shivers. But the thing is, though, there's so much processing that goes on, you know, in the creation of all these things that something like that happens, and it might be a disgusting potato, but I think you fry anything long enough, you know, put enough seasoning on anything, and it ultimately becomes difficult to tell what's wrong with it.
Sorry, just monitoring levels, that's all. Yeah, you're right. Other known fact about New York fries, all the potatoes from Boise, Idaho.
Okay.
But I guess Idaho fries didn't have the same ring as New York fries.
Yeah. Why did they call it New York fries? Because the style?
I guess.
The way they cut it?
I don't know. I don't know what the New York influence
is. I don't know if I necessarily trust potatoes grown in, like, Manhattan.
Yeah, maybe not. I mean, that would explain maybe some of the maggots coming from the sewers.
Yeah.
What's going on in your life, Wei?
Just not much, man.
Just another Wednesday morning?
Yeah, just another Wednesday. Kind of recovered from Monday.
Monday is always a long day.
Long day, long show. What else is going on?
You watching any television right now? Any non-fighting?
Let me think about that.
I just saw the season premiere of Sons of Anarchy on the weekend.
Okay.
And
about that.
I won't ruin anything because it has been not nearly enough years.
Yeah.
But it was a 90-minute season premiere.
And it's the final season.
It's the final season. The final ride. That's the hashtag. And it sounds like there's going to be a lot of bloodshed in this final season of Sons of Anarchy.
The last ride.
The last ride.
Yeah.
The final ride.
That's what they should have called
it. I know. They're going to powerbomb somebody.
Yeah.
Give them a wedgie at the same time. The final scene, Wei, was so violent that I had to turn my head away. I couldn't watch it.
It was like that bad? So somebody dies in the first episode of already?
Yes.
Whoa.
Deaths are fairly common on Sons of Anarchy. It's different degrees of characters.
It's I suppose it's good and bad. It's good in that I think of all the episodes, people are going to tune into either the series finale or the series premiere the most, right? So I guess if you want your death to be seen, it's good to die.
This wasn't a major death. This was a character that was only introduced on this episode. So it wasn't somebody of real significance, but plays into a bigger plot line.
Right. Aren't you amazed that is Katie Sagal still alive? Is she in it?
I don't know if I should comment on that. I'm very worried about offending people.
Okay, never mind then. But she at least at the start of the season, she's still alive.
She might be. Or she might have died in season 2.
Oh, never mind.
What if people are starting right now? Wait, you're ruining things.
I thought she was in the whole
You talk
show,
about
man.
TV shows, Wait, it's walking on eggshells. You're going to mess up somewhere along the line. Well, you're going to upset somebody out there.
If she died in season two, then it's already been, what, 4 years? I'd say that's okay. Okay? So she's dead. Is that what you're saying?
She's buried with children.
But I was just going to say, I mean, she's had quite the lengthy career.
Look at, Married with Children, which was always one of my favorite shows when I was a child. I mean, those, outside of Bud, I mean, Ed O'Neill, Kay Segal, and...
Christina Applegate.
They've all segued into mm-hmm. success.
Yeah.
Ed O'Neill, clearly, bigger show now than Married with Children ever was, in my opinion, with Modern Family. I think Modern Family has surpassed Married with Children.
I can't comment.
Sons of Anarchy,
that.
Certainly bigger than Married with Children. Katie Segal, she was in the Anchorman films.
She was in Futurama.
She was in Futurama. And she had another sitcom for a while.
No, you're talking about Christina Applegate.
Yeah.
Yeah, you said Katie Segal.
Well, Katie Segal, I'm saying...
She was in Anchorman. Christina
No,
Applegate
that's what I was talking about, Way. Yes, Christina Applegate
yeah, but you
was in Anchorman. Okay. I apologize. And what's Bud done?
He's appeared at the Niagara Falls Comic Con, sitting next to Ric Flair and Kelly Kelly.
Oh wow! What a star-studded lineup.
It's huge. Well, I think
probably would have been more receptive to an interview. I would think.
Definitely. Yeah.
Or he could have been one of those celebrities who's like, I won't talk about my Bud Bundy years.
we saw him chatting up with Kelly Kelly a little bit, so maybe he was talking to him about that. But I think his problem was he managed to stay the same height his entire career. He's still the same height as, you know, his teenage self. So I don't know how many roles there necessarily are for
a short man.
Yeah.
I always think of him and Seth Green as, like, the same person.
Because they're both, like, kind
they're
of...
They're both short.
Short.
Both kind of similar. Man. Like, I could totally buy that they were brothers in some other realm.
Yeah, why is that? Because...
there's just a similarity about the two.
Yeah, that's true. I feel like they played similar characters.
Yeah, they kind of did.
Anyway...
The oddball brother.
Yeah.
I guess the Jeffersons really didn't go anywhere after Married with Children either.
No. What about Steve?
Steve Rhodes.
Yeah.
He just disappeared. I never even understood what the story was there. I wonder if he just had a contract issue and left the show.
Yeah.
And then in came Jefferson Darcy and the birth of Marcy Darcy after they got married.
And Seven.
Seven. Oh, I just put that out of my head.
That was when they jumped the shark.
Yeah, the low years of Married with Children.
Yeah.
It was a fun little show.
Yeah, it was.
All it lasted.
Yeah.
It was a controversial show at the time. I remember my mom didn't want me to watch Married with Children because it got all this...
about sex.
Yeah, I was like...
Kidding me?
Watch that show now. It's so tame.
Little does she know, you review pro wrestling, which is very sexual.
It's on a sliding scale, I guess. You can have wholesome and you can have adult content in pro wrestling.
Uh-huh.
I want you to really put your thinking cap on of what we're going to review next week. I want something that you're going to enjoy.
I'm still trying to get this visual of maggots in a potato out of my head.
Well, maybe that'll take you to some FMW stip matches. Some scorpions in plates of glass.
That is just like horrifying. That's like horror movie type of stuff.
Stuff gets rotten. Haven't you ever eaten something rotten before? Have you ever had milk that's expired?
Not with maggots inside. That's a different level of rotten.
To me, I have like once or twice in my life gone to drink milk that has spoiled. And dude, it's makes me want to gag right now just thinking of it.
It's our second gag of the podcast.
Yeah.
It's already a record.
It's things you attach mental images to, I think, that are most disturbing. Still to this day, I never want to have grape juice because this girl in senior kindergarten vomited grape juice all over the floor. And that's all I think of. That mental image will be with me till the day I die.
Interesting.
Of grape juice being vomited out. That was just this mass circle.
That's
and kids
gross.
Being dicks just laughing at her because she had the temerity to vomit.
Yeah, puke is kind of funny.
Puke is really gross, though,
it
as well.
Is. Yeah. But just you won't touch vomit? Would you touch like a...
What do you mean touch?
Well, drink.
Drink
sorry,
vomit?
Sorry. I meant grape.
What the fuck are you into with your friends? Jesus Christ.
I meant grape juice. You just won't even...
I don't want to have it because I don't have... I just have that image. And I don't hate grape-flavored things.
Okay.
Just straight grape juice.
So will you drink like a grape... Or like Grape Crush?
I never have.
How about like a grape Gatorade?
Maybe.
That's a maybe.
I've had a grape energy drink before. That's been fine.
But grape, straight up, like Welch's grape juice.
If I had a glass of grape juice, I don't think.
Wow.
I don't think it's been enough time yet.
Okay. Interesting.
It's only been about 25
years. I like grape juice. It tastes good.
I don't mind the flavor of grape. It's fine with me.
What if it was grape-flavored juice, but it was colored green? You know it's just like coloring, right?
That sounds terrible. You know what's the worst flavor to replicate I've found is watermelon. Watermelon-flavored anything sucks.
Yeah.
I've had watermelon gum. Horrible.
Yeah, I don't like it.
I had this watermelon protein powder once that I wanted to just die after having
of
it.
Of all the choices, why would you pick watermelon?
I love watermelon, but I realize you cannot replicate watermelon unless it's the straight up OG watermelon.
Watermelon definitely does not taste like what watermelon should. Watermelon flavored things.
Yeah, the more distinct the flavor, the more they are fucking around to nail down that taste. Yeah.
But I'd say like the worst replicated type of thing you could have for like candy and all that is like licorice, like a licorice jelly bean.
What the hell's a licorice jelly bean?
It's like usually the black jelly beans.
Oh, okay.
And
yeah, those are gross. I never liked.
I don't know why anybody would want to replicate that. But like if you just kind of ate, you know, like Twizzlers for instance on their own, yeah, it's tasty candy. But I don't know, just the black anything, it's kind of gross.
Black licorice was always gross. People used to just eat that when I was a kid as a dare. No one ever, I'm going to enjoy this candy. It's a treat.
Are there any chip flavors that you stay away from?
All of them. I don't eat chips.
You don't eat chips?
You're not
a chips guy?
No. Nachos, fine. Chips, no.
Why don't you like chips? Oh, because of your potato experience.
No, not because of that. I just never, as a kid, I never liked chips, ever.
Chips are my weakness.
Oh, really?
I'll tell you. Yeah, but I'll tell you what I don't like. Salt and vinegar potato chips.
Why is that?
It's just...
It's gross, right? There's certain foods you just know are gross, and you just know you're not going to like them.
But I used to feel that way about dill pickle, and now I love dill pickle chips.
So your taste buds have evolved.
Yeah. But they haven't for certain things, like salt and vinegar. I don't get it. I don't get people who like that stuff.
When I was in sixth grade, we were having some girl's birthday party in our classroom, and she's just going around and just pours chips on everyone's like little plate that they had. First of all, got chips like right near my cake. So I won't eat the cake now that chips have touched it. And I also have to subtly throw these chips out because I'm not going to fucking touch them. So I just had to subtly throw them out. And then the teacher catches me and is like, why are you throwing out your food? That's wasteful. I was like, shut up. I don't want to eat these. So either I put them back into the fucking chip bag and you can redistribute them to the class, or I'm throwing them out in the garbage. Like, for fuck's sake. And then they always, without question, whenever you couldn't finish food, think of people that are dying out there. It's like, how can I possibly comprehend such a drastic problem? I am 8 years old, and I just don't want to eat this. And you're putting the fucking guilt onto me for not eating some fucking potato chips. Jesus Christ. Think of the people that can't even afford food. That's a dick thing to say to an 8 year old. That was roughly, I think that was grade six, so that would have been the fall of 1996, right around fall brawl.
Wow.
No, probably not. Probably younger, but this was an event. We gave no thought when we decided this. This was based upon the fact that you were looking at my tapes last weekend, and this came to mind.
This is the first tape I touched of your tape collection.
Did you watch any of the VHS version, or was this all an online
viewing? No, I watched portions of it. But you know what? Last week I said how I enjoyed VHS more than digital.
Has that changed?
Yeah, I think I'd take it back. Because I took your tape, I popped it into the VCR, and your tape was stuck in the middle. Like, I was in the middle of this six-hour tape.
Oh.
I had to put it in.
Wait, and the thing holding you back was pressing rewind?
Yeah,
be kind.
It's a lot.
Just rewind.
It's a lot of work and a lot of time to wait.
You were lazy. That's a 2 minute rewind.
Here's the whole process. Here's the whole process you know, of me watching John's VHS tape. First of all, I get home. I have the tape sitting around. I go to turn on my VCR. My VCR is not even plugged in. I don't remember the last time I even used my VCR. So I had to free an empty slot from the power bar, plug in the VCR. Then I hit the power button. Then I pop the tape in. This is already like five steps, okay? And then I see that your tape is stuck in the middle. Who doesn't rewind their tapes after that? I guess you had just finished transferring.
You had just stolen this tape. All right, fine,
whatever.
It was in mid-transfer.
I had to sit there. I had to wait for this tape to rewind. I don't know how long it took me.
Boy.
It feels like it took 5 minutes for this thing to rewind to the beginning. Luckily, it was at the beginning. If it was like one of the shows that you had taped in the middle, I don't know how I would have found it. It would have been an impossible process. And I had to wait.
I believe this tape had Fall Brawl, a Starrcade, and a Clash of Champions all put onto it.
Very convenient, though, for you to put all the WCW on the single tape. So that made sense. But anyway, I hit play finally. Then I see a line. First of all, the quality is terrible. It sucks. It's like, it's not even like stereo. Because something's wrong with it, so it kept flicking between mono and stereo, and it just eventually I had enough of the flickering, so I just kept it on mono. But then there's this line across the bottom, like what is this line? It's just like this like little bit of fuzz. And then, do you know what tracking is?
Jesus Christ, this is the funniest conversation.
It's like,
have you never used tracking? Most VCRs have auto tracking.
Well, not my VCR, I suppose.
I had to control
the track. I had to press the up and down till I got rid of the stupid
line.
This
is how people had to live, like, not even 15 years ago.
This was like, I mean, I don't remember doing this on the WWE Network, finding the tracking to make sure the line was okay. And the quality was just bad. I had to, it just wasn't that much fun. And John, I mean, thank you, John, but...
John
records like the pre-shows too.
No, this was actually a tape that Dan Lavransky dubbed for me.
Okay, whatever. I blame one of you guys.
Fine.
And so
what's wrong with the pre-show?
I'm not going to sit down and watch 3.5 hours of a show.
I skipped the pre-show.
I had to fast forward through the pre-show now. So by the time I actually got to watch the pay-per-view, I was already like 10 minutes in. So it wasn't that enjoyable.
Wow.
VHS.
Wow.
I take it back. I've had a rough week.
Think of the children out there that can't watch any wrestling, and you're complaining about tracking, and having too much stuff to watch.
Yeah, well,
you've got to really get those priorities back in order. Fall Brawl, Sunday, September the 15th of 1996. We just surpassed the anniversary, the 18-year anniversary of this event.
Wow, that long.
Yep, this past Monday was the anniversary. Winston-Salem, North Carolina, which had become the home of Fall Brawl, from the Lawrence Jewell Coliseum, and all I made from the pre-show was some commercials featuring Sergeant Craig Pittman running a boot camp.
Who is that?
Sergeant Craig Pittman was this, I think, former Marine who had come into WCW and was kind of given this, like, pseudo shooter gimmick.
Is that the power plant guy? The same?
Yes.
The Sarge?
No, that was Dwayne Bruce. Okay. Sergeant Buddy Lee Parker. This was another sergeant.
Okay.
Not to be confused with a Buddy Lee Parker or Chris Melendez or Slaughter. And his finisher was the Code Red, which was an armbar.
Okay.
Yep. That was his finish. At one point, actually, he was in talks to WCW was going to let him do a UFC tournament, but it didn't happen.
Wow.
Back here in the 90s. It wasn't even on this show, but was all over the ad. Because for Fall Brawl, Craig Pittman running a boot camp. That's how we're going to sell this pay-per-view. This was just 2 months after they had launched the whole Hogan joining the NWO. So certainly there was a lot of buzz behind WCW at the time. This was when I had started watching WCW because we had just started getting a one-hour edited version of Nitro up here in Canada. So you actually got to see...
VR. Where did this air?
I think it was on like
TSN?
CH actually. Oh. And it would be like 6 days after Nitro aired. It would be a Sunday afternoon, 1 hour edited version of Nitro. And that was the only way to see Nitro in Canada at the time. The show opens with a video featuring the formation of the NWO with highlights. They showed all these different visuals, including a close-up of some sheriff's gun. Like he's about to brandish his firearm. They just showed this close-up, interspersed with random shots of the NWO. So they are under attack, and they might have to beat them with a gun. Mm-hmm. That's the only way to combat the NWO. Showed the Giant joining up with the NWO, this fake version of Sting attacking Lex Luger on the Nitro coming into Fall Brawl, and a car being destroyed by baseball bats. And the show begins with the proclamation by Tony Schiavone that war is in the air. And that would be the start of tonight's show with Tony Schiavone, Bobby Heenan, and the star of the announce team for the next 3 hours, Dusty Rhodes. Dusty Rhodes was in fine form on this Fall Brawl.
He definitely
pay-per-view.
Was. How often would he do commentary?
Oh, he would do... I mean, he was on all the pay-per-views, and then he was also doing, I think, Saturday night at the time. And I can't remember. Nitro... I don't think he was on Nitro at this point.
Hmm.
So anyway, this was a... You had to pay to hear Dusty, yeah. As I recall. And they are... setting up the idea that Sting has joined the NWO. That was the angle they went off Nitro with, and we're going to find out for sure tonight. Heenan says that guys are in the back taking bets that this could be the NWO's final pay-per-view. They would be wrong. And they put a big, big emphasis on how important tonight is for WCW and really making this a one-match show in terms of an attraction. It's the War Games match with a team of WCW members taking on the NWO team. And we started things off with Diamond Dallas Page taking on Chavo Guerrero Jr., a young upstart, Chavo Guerrero Jr., mm-hmm. here in 1996. And they had a pretty good match here. One thing is that of these matches, it was what felt like a lot of cold matches that got a lot of time with talented guys.
Yeah.
And if you are watching this today... you're just watching these matches without really any rhyme or reason. It's not like these had video packages to build them up. It's not like you had much storyline at the time to really have a context of the match. It was kind of just, here you go. Enjoy.
Yeah. If they did have storylines, they didn't necessarily feel like storylines that the crowd were really connecting with. But if you're simply watching it for, you know, for a sort of work rate purposes, I think you'd enjoy it in hindsight. But at the time... there were some good matches, but clearly people that the crowd wasn't really connecting with a lot.
Yeah, that would definitely be fair. This was a crowd that very much they reacted to stars and to the lesser knowns. It didn't matter what they were doing in the ring. If they weren't seen as stars, the crowd really did sit on their hands. The only thing they explained really going into this one was that Chavo beat Diamond Dallas Page on an episode of Nitro, which was a big upset setting up the rematch. Page here, though, I saw the crowd kind of taking to him as a babyface for a lot of his spots in this match, particularly when he would hit some of his big spots.
Well, I couldn't really tell who was supposed to be heel or babyface because Chavo comes in immediately and just starts whipping him on the outside with like a belt
with
or something. And throughout the whole show, I mean, I didn't know what was like a legal. Or not. Somehow, I mean, this was in plain view of the referee.
Yeah,
before
belts
the match
are typically
started.
Not legal.
So, you know, here's Chavo, supposedly the babyface whipping on his opponent, DDP.
Where did this belt come from?
Somebody probably, I don't know, just felt...
just all of a sudden old. He had a belt and he was whipping him with it.
I mean, a lot of people wear belts.
Yeah, well, did he take this off a man?
Somebody maybe just...
he didn't bring one.
Had a big dinner.
Some big stuff from Chavo here. He hit the springboard crossbody as he's making a comeback on DDP. Hits a missile dropkick off the top for a two count. Hits a Hurricane Rana off the top, getting a near fall. And they went back and forth with a series of near falls. Page tosses Chavo into the second ring. And then Chavo hits a tilt-a-whirl head scissors, described by Dusty as the Whirly Birdie.
Much better name.
The Whirly Birdie there. Then there was a spinning sit-out powerbomb by Page for another near fall. He calls for the diamond cutter. Chavo goes for a backslide. It's countered, and DDP hits the diamond cutter, which does get a babyface reaction, and he pins Chavo at 13 minutes and 7 seconds.
A lot of time these two got, as would a lot of these matches. But I thought overall a good opening match. I thought Chavo looked great as this young rookie high flyer, and I was impressed by DDP as well. I thought the two meshed well together.
Yeah, this was at a point when DDP was certainly not at the level he would be a year from this point, but someone that worked very hard, put together his matches in, you know, very specific detail, and was getting over at this point.
Yeah, and I'd say like his biggest strength is that he always carried a charisma with him.
Yeah.
That was even apparent at this stage.
They noted that you could log on to CompuServe on the internet and type in Go Convention and talk with WCW wrestlers on CompuServe.
CompuServe.
Yes, and you could chat with Harlem Heat, Sherry, and Colonel Robert Parker right now on the internet in 1996.
Wow.
So some forward thinking here.
The internet.
The internet. Gene Okerlund then had a WCW special report to discuss the attack.
Like, as dated as all that stuff sounds, that's exactly how Twitter is going to sound like, you know, 20 years from now when people review these episodes of Raw and whatever, you know.
Yeah.
Hashtags.
Remember back in the days when you couldn't just type in a wrestler and their hologram would appear to talk to you in the seat next to you? God, this shit was lame. You had to type down your messages.
Yeah.
Instead of Google reading your mind and just auto-sending it to another person's brain function.
In 20 years, yeah.
It's going to happen. Gene Okerlund, this whole segment was basically a background of the NWO from Memorial Day with Scott Hall showing up, Nash coming the following week, powerbombing Eric Bischoff at the Great American Bash, the reveal of Hogan. And then they showed this great clip of this limo driving away and Randy Savage diving on top of the limo.
Yeah.
And they drive away with Savage on top of it at a fairly high speed. I was amazed Randy Savage lived this one.
I imagine when you get into character, you feel like you're somewhat invincible to do things like surfing a limousine.
Sure.
But man, I like this package. It was just basically me and Gene in front of a green screen explaining, you know, the whole story behind the NWO in its short two-month existence. But I'll say, even in its short two-month existence, you can already see how mishandled this whole thing already was, okay? All these people that they turn on at the beginning of the story, you know, Savage, the Giant, you know, Luger, these are all people that...
Sting.
These are all people that will join them.
Yep.
That'll all join the group, like, within a very short amount of time.
I always thought it was major mistakes. To a lesser degree, Luger, because he was one of the major babyfaces. And I understand the Wolfpack was supposed to be like this babyface group. But Sting especially, when he put on that NWO shirt, it's just like, to me, that was, you know, the Starrcade match was very much botched. But Sting joining the NWO, even if it was the Wolfpack, to me, it went against the entire storyline. That Sting was like the one guy that was standing up for WCW to fight them. And you're right. This would be the Giant here. The last pay-per-view, the NWO took out this guy, took his title, and here on this pay-per-view, he's joined them already.
Yeah.
And there never was that much of an explanation for the Giant joining. It was just a swerve where he came in and attacked the Dungeon of Doom, his teammates, and then joined the NWO. They also showed Ted DiBiase had debuted as their financial backer as well during this time. Then we had a submission match between Scott Norton and Ice Train, and they were accompanied by a man who they claimed was Teddy Long, I believe was a man who may have eaten Teddy Long.
Yeah.
This guy was gigantic.
This is the fat Teddy Long.
Holy Christ. There was like Scott Putski Teddy Long in the early 90s. This was, I don't know, like thyroid problem Teddy Long. He was huge.
I thought you were going to name a fat wrestler.
Well, he was just... This was a heavy man in 1996. Like, unrecognizable to the Teddy Long you are familiar with of the past 10 years.
He seemed about twice the size of...
Like,
the
not
Teddy
exaggerating.
Long,
he might have been 75 pounds heavier here.
But, you know, as a result, he came across a bit more intimidating, you know, and tough looking.
This was the godfather, Teddy Long.
Yeah, big Teddy Long. When did he join the WWF?
He came in 99 as a referee.
Okay.
So it would be about 3 years after this, less than that.
Who is this Ice Train?
Ice Train was just a random guy that was paired with Scott Norton for the incredibly charismatic team of Fire and Ice.
Mm-hmm.
And this was their big breakup.
Gotcha.
Let's have a submission match with these two muscle heads. Dusty Rhodes is describing that their arms are as big as tree trunks and their chests are as big as the Grand Canyon, and says it's going to be hard to, quote, uncle one of these two.
So bad.
It's going to be hard to uncle one of these two. Uncle them. There was a DDT to Ice Train. Then he ran into a power slam by Ice Train. There's a camel clutch. Norton applies an arm bar. Tony Schiavone actually noted that the technique was not properly applied here, where Scott Norton was not lifting up his hips for this arm bar.
Oh.
It was also crossing his feet way.
Yes. No nos.
What was Scott thinking?
But Ronda Rousey does that sometimes.
I guess you can. I've always been taught it's better not to to clasp your legs, but I guess to each his own. Mm-hmm. There was a reverse neck breaker, which was identified as a jawbreaker. Ice Train hit an inverted arm bar, then a senton, and then Norton with a spine buster. Crowd did not care about this at all. Finally, Teddy Long gets on the apron. Norton goes to lift him, and Ice Train attacks him from behind and applies a full Nelson, and Norton taps out at 7 minutes and 10 seconds.
And this was before the era of the tap, was it not?
Yeah, this was, I mean, in Japan, it was definitely introduced at this point, but this certainly predates WWF.
They even had a microphone there for the verbal submission.
Yeah, we got the verbal, the actual physical tap here from mm-hmm. Scott Norton.
Yeah.
What a match.
Okay, I'll say it exceeded my expectations. You know, on paper, you just see Scott Norton. I think Scott Norton's actually, you know, quite talented. But
he got over very well in New Japan.
Yeah.
As a foreigner.
But I wasn't really expecting much out of this versus Ice Train. But I'll say the two had a pretty decent, you know, power style type of match. So it was okay. Not it's definitely not you know, not ideal for them to be in this type of matchup. But I'd say it was okay, you know.
Then we had the Mexican heavyweight title on the line.
Yeah, was this a joke?
This sounds like just a bullshit title pulled out of the thin air.
It sounds like a Lance Storm
the
title.
The Saskatchewan Hardcore International title.
Well, especially...
This is the Tijuana.
Especially considering who the holder was.
Conan.
Oh, was he the actual champion?
They billed him here as the Mexican heavyweight champion.
Okay, because I thought it was... Well, then the challenger.
Juventud Guerrera.
Not exactly a heavyweight.
Yeah, they immediately outlined the fact that Conan outweighs this man by 50 pounds as they're competing for the heavyweight title.
The Mexican heavyweight title. How long did this thing exist? Was there a physical title even?
He didn't come out with one.
Yeah.
I think it was just a random title. They probably couldn't promote anything with a specific organization's name attached to it, so they just said the generic title that wouldn't get them into any legal issues. Even with a working agreement or not.
Was Conan a AAA champion at the time?
He didn't hold any title at this point.
So what the hell was all this?
It's just a random title to announce him as.
Just the key is what it was. He didn't even come up with anything.
Yeah, sure. It's a title match.
Just the graphic.
Yeah, everyone's got titles. So, Hoovy, I pray you were watching this. Hoovy comes down to the ring and turns his back to the audience as he's looking into the camera as he's ringside, and he's backing up and falls over the steps.
Oh, I actually skipped it.
He tumbled over, and they immediately cut away. This was great.
Oh, poor
Hoovy falling over.
Poor Hoovy.
The match begins. There was a full release German delivered to Hoovy, and Hoovy gets rotated onto his chest. Heenan is explaining that, oh, by the way, Mike Tenay is joining the commentary team, thank God, for this particular match, for background. Heenan explains that Conan has been Americanized, and that's why he has this new look. And Mike Tenay absolutely shoots down this. He says, no, actually, Bobby, it's the exact opposite. He's gone back to his roots, and he is representing Mexican culture now with his new look. And Bobby was just silent. You know? He's like, Mike, take over.
Yeah.
There was a suicide dive by Hoovy. Hoovy then jumped off the top of the guardrail into a Hurricane Rana, but Conan catches him with a power bomb.
Like, I'm just imagining what Bobby Heenan would envision to be traditional Mexican clothing, like ponchos.
He's thinking of like probably El Matador, Tito Santana.
Yeah.
This was great because after Conan powerbombs Hoovy on the floor, we got Jimmy Hart cackling and yelling, Arriba la raza, into the camera. Yeah. Jimmy Hart, of course, managing Conan, who was part of the Dungeon of Doom. Because when you think Dungeon of Doom, you think Conan,
yeah.
Of course. They plugged the hotline, including Mike Tenay and his interview with Eric Bischoff about internet rumors involving Kevin Nash and Scott Hall, which at this time was when WWE was promoting that Razor Ramon and Diesel will be returning to the WWF as the fake versions would be appearing the next week. The camera then missed a springboard splash by Hoovy as he goes to the floor. Dusty notes how Hoovy is flipping and flopping him. Then there was a pair of two consecutive Germans by Conan delivered to Hoovy. They're fighting on the apron. Hoovy goes for a sunset flip off the apron. That gets blocked, and Conan hits a drop kick off of the apron. I was very impressed with some of Conan's offense in this match. Not a guy that's always known for his high-risk offense, but there was a lot of it in this particular match. And Heenan notes the fact that he's glad Conan has more of an edge because you, quote, can't come into WCW and just pussyfoot around.
It's obvious to me that he's had quite an attitude change. And that's good for him because here at WCW, you can't come in here and pussyfoot around. You better be a man.
I like that, a pussyfoot term.
Pussyfoot, yeah.
Don't pussyfoot around. There was a wheelbarrow slam by Conan. They're into the ropes. The referee won't cover. Then Hoovy hits this somersault leg drop to Conan, who's draped on the middle rope. Conan then kicks out of a 450 splash. No reaction by the crowd for that. Hoovy hits this twisting splash off the top. And then Conan finishes with what looked to be a muscle buster and then an outsider's edge off the second turnbuckle.
It was Splash Mountain.
Splash Mountain off the second turnbuckle. And Conan pins him at 13 minutes 46 seconds. This match exceeded my expectations. Like, we know Hoovy was great, but I thought this was a good showcase of Conan as well, who you don't typically put in these kind of high-flying lucha matches.
Yeah. It was entertaining, definitely, but I couldn't help but, while watching it, to like, I got a strange sense that the two were trying to outdo one another, especially Hoovy here. There were a lot of instances where it just felt like he was trying to get his shit in. Like,
well, that was always one of Hoovy's reps.
Jumping and spinning for no real reasons. Going up top and, you know, doing one high spot after another, even though they weren't necessarily getting big reactions. It just almost felt like he was doing it for the sake of being able to do it. And as a result, I didn't feel like it was really well-paced enough to maximize their reactions from this audience. And I mean, I also got the sense that maybe this is just me like writing some type of narrative in my mind, but I got the sense that like Conan might have been pissed off about that because he just ragdolled Juventud throughout this entire match. Like, he just whipped him around, like, you know, like we haven't seen Conan do to many people. So everything that he did almost looked stiff, and as a result, it was very entertaining. But I thought it was a little sloppy and disjointed at times.
Wait, this was for the Mexican Heavyweight Championship.
Oh, yeah, it's true.
You don't pussyfoot around in these kinds of a match.
Yes.
Then we had Chris Jericho, who was making his first WCW pay-per-view appearance in this match, taking on Chris Benoit, which this was a match that I'm sure if you were a diehard wrestling fan at the time, these two are coming off their match at the Super J Cup from the year prior. So this probably had a lot of at least buzz amongst wrestling fans for this particular match. No real program going into this. Just two guys that got to go out for 15 minutes and have a great match. They started with these slaps back and forth.
Did these two ever work together in ECW?
I don't think they ever had a singles match. Like, Chris Jericho, it was a very small time he was there in ECW. It was only like a handful of like episodes he was even there, his ECW tenure. So I don't think they did have a singles match. So this would probably be their first singles match in North America, at least. I don't think they crossed paths in Mexico, and then
or Canada
probably for that matter. I think it wasn't until New Japan that they had a singles match. They're going back and forth with slaps. Crowd is getting into all of Benoit's offense. He applies the Lion Tamer to Chris Jericho early on in the match.
Yeah, that's where he learned it.
There were these back and forth pinfall attempts. Jericho does a springboard dropkick off the turnbuckle to Benoit, sending him off the apron. Camera misses this back elbow off the second rope to the floor that Jericho hit. Crowd was actually booing Jericho here. He hit a tiger suplex, but Benoit's into the ropes. They have a big exchange of chops. Benoit hits his diving headbutt off the top, only getting a two count. Jericho with a small package comes back. There's a more pinfall attempts by Jericho. He hits a Northern Light suplex for a two count. Jericho then reverses a tombstone, hits the tombstone, but then misses a quebrada and lands on his feet. There's a clothesline by Jericho for a two count. Dusty is predicting that Jericho will be a major star in WCW. And then Jericho hits a top rope Frankensteiner, just like we saw against Bray Wyatt last week. This is the tie of Chris Jericho. And then Benoit back suplexes him off the top after stopping him on the top. And the back suplex wins the match for Benoit, 14-39. And I thought the announcers did a pretty good job here of putting over Chris Jericho and how he put up a great fight and having a lot of potential here in WCW.
Yeah, I thought so. I thought that they did a good job putting over Benoit, too. This was, where was the show exactly?
North Carolina.
Oh, okay, yes. So clearly Chris Benoit, the more over of the two with his Horseman affiliation. And even at this stage, you could tell these two guys, especially Benoit, they're already quite seasoned. Definitely Benoit.
We then go to the Cruiserweight title match. Rey Mysterio against Super Kalo. Super Kalo.
Yeah.
Named after a Mexican rap group.
That's what they explain.
Yes.
Not the Wizard of Oz.
Yes.
Or, sorry, Mary Poppins.
Mary Poppins. Yeah. These two, I thought, had a really fun match, and this crowd couldn't possibly care for most of it. There was a running power slam to Rey.
This was actually for the Cruiserweight title.
Yes, for the Cruiserweight title with Rey defending it. There was a running power slam to Rey, and following that, it was pretty much Super Kalo taking the majority of the early portion of the match. This also featured Dusty saying the words, "Lordy, lordy, booty, booty, booty," in reference to some offensive sequence. Kalo bounces him off the top rope into a powerbomb for a two count. This was essentially like I don't want to say a tryout match, but this was Super Kalo's, like, maybe his biggest match in WCW, really, because they did nothing with this guy during his time here. Kalo is working over the left arm. Dusty compares it to a night when Pat O'Connor applied an armbar on him one night for 30 straight minutes. And Kalo continues working over the left arm, applies an inverted surfboard. Heenan asks if luchadors ever try to take the other's masks off. And Mike Tenay, thank God he was here, then explained that sometimes they will build up to mask versus mask matches, which then leads to Dusty asking if the loser of a mask versus mask match has to unmask. This was unbelievable. Rey hit this very weird splash to take Super Kalo over the top to the floor, then hit a somersault dive to him on the floor. Kalo comes back with the advantage. He's fighting into the other ring. Rey hits the springboard off the top and then a Hurricane Rana off the apron to the floor, which looked great. Then a springboard somersault dive to the floor onto Kalo, followed by a springboard sunset flip. All of these moves he's doing, the crowd just not even with a pulse. And it ends with Rey doing a backflip off the top rope into the second ring, then a double springboard into the move that would later become the West Coast Pop in the WWE. And pins Super Kalo at 15 minutes and 46 seconds. I've never seen such a disconnect between all this action that's happening and a crowd that just didn't seem into anything but the finish.
Yeah, the crowd, you can't really blame them. They just weren't familiar with who these people were. And I don't think there was as much of importance placed on the in-ring product at the time so that people would go to these shows just to see good wrestling. I think people came to these shows to see Hulk Hogan, to see these personalities. And, you know, all of a sudden you had Super Kalo and Rey Mysterio, who nobody knew at the time. They were just quiet because of the lack of star power. It's fun, though, going back and watching these because, especially with a guy like Rey, you get to see how he is today compared to how he was back then. And for one thing, you know, being half the size, he was also much more dynamic with his high-flying moveset, a lot more different, you know.
It was incredible at this time period what he could do.
Mm-hmm. So it was a lot of fun to watch him, and I thought Super Kalo did a great job.
I thought he was one of the best performers on this show, and really, like, he was just total undercard during his whole run. He'd be thrown into like six-man tags. This was probably his biggest match in WCW, and he was a really, really talented cruiserweight. Then we go to Harlem Heat with Colonel Parker and Sherry defending the tag titles against the Nasty Boys, which went 15 and a half minutes. The announcers say to not expect anything that you saw in the last match in this one. Sags is on the floor, and all match long, they would try to be getting their hands on Sherry, which, to their credit, the crowd was just buzzing for. They just wanted to see Sherry get hers in this particular match. The Nasties are double-teaming Booker T. They call for the pit stop, but Knobs grabs Booker, and Sherry gets onto the apron to distract, and then Stevie Ray attacks Knobs from behind, led to a long heat spot, beating down on Knobs. Finally, Knobs went after Sherry, gets attacked by Booker on the floor, and then Sags is going after, running into the ring, but she gets away. Sags finally gets the hot tag, comes in, attacking both members of Harlem Heat, tosses Sherry into the ring for what may have been the biggest reaction thus far on the show, and leads to a near fall for Sags. Fans pop big as if it was the finish. Sags is a pile driver to Booker T. Stevie Ray makes the save. Sags is then on top, and Colonel Parker hits him with a cane, just barely, and Sags just flops down to the mat. He's taken out to the floor by Stevie Ray, and then Sherry and Parker are attacking Sags on the floor. Dusty Rhodes notes how Harlem Heat is, quote, stomping a mud hole into Jerry Sags, which may be the historical start of stomping a mud hole. Maybe Jim Ross was watching his Dusty Rhodes commentary.
You think so?
And that was what he stole? I don't know. They get the heat on Jerry Sags. Finally makes a hot tag to Knobs, who comes in. All four are fighting in the ring. Referee Mark Curtis is just randomly counting into thin air as these four are fighting. And then Knobs is on top. Sherry hits him with the cane behind the referee's back, and Booker gets the pinfall on Knobs. 15 minutes, 32 seconds. To their credit, the crowd was really into this, but I just thought this really dragged.
This was the complete opposite of the previous match in that you had star power, and well-known names in Harlem Heat and the Nasty Boys, but really bad wrestling, I felt. I just thought, especially from the Nasty Boys, you know, really ugly, really sloppy work. But then again, you know, they're not called the Graceful Boys. It sort of fits the gimmick.
Oh, man, what a awesome heel turn that would have been.
The Graceful Boys, and all of a sudden they just work like beautifully technically sound matches.
Yes, and they could, since they're heels, they could, Jerry would become Gerald, the Ricky Morton rule.
Yeah.
You know what was hilarious was recently I was watching, I'm trying to catch up on The Sopranos, and there's this scene where Tony Soprano's sister is having a conversation with her fiance about his son Richie and keeps calling him Richie, and the father freaks out saying his name is not Richie, it's Richard. Richie is a child's name. And it was like just days after we were talking about Ricky Morton becoming Richard Morton.
Oh, interesting.
What a tie-in.
Yeah.
Anyway, not a great match, but fuck, if the crowd reacts, the crowd reacts, and they got over in their tag match. So you can criticize the wrestling all you want, but you're out there to get a reaction, and they got more of one than most of the matches on this show.
Yeah, it's hard to criticize. I feel like I am able to criticize from watching this 20 years later from my own perspective, because I consider myself part of the audience too. And
wow, look at that.
Well, what?
It's a great point.
There are different audiences for...
I didn't like this match.
Yeah, and the other thing I found that was kind of offensive about it was just how little tact there was in the interferences. All the interferences here from Sherry and Bob Parker, they were just so blatant. Like, no thought really put into how they would sneak in. Like, Sherry would just walk in, and it would be up to the referee to just, like...
look like an idiot.
I understand this is pro wrestling. I'm complaining about something that's a mainstay in pro wrestling, but I would like a bit of effort put into it. This is just Sherry casually walking into the ring, hitting somebody with the, whatever, the pole, and the referee just, like, tuning everything else out. It just... I want some level of believability, and I definitely didn't really find it in this.
Then we got a rare promo in between matches. I will say this. I hate the WCW structuring of these shows, where it's just match, next match, next match. Like, just give me a promo backstage, something to take me down from one match and get me ready for the next.
Right.
Like, you'll never see this kind of a...
But they didn't always have shows like this. I mean, they would have shows where they would kind of do that.
I find for the majority of WCW shows, it always felt very formulaic, right. Whereas WWE, they would always have stuff in between matches.
Yeah,
packages. And I thought that was just... Yeah.
But also, like, I suppose in place of those packages, they would just sometimes put in these random matches. Of, like, I don't know, just like filler matches, basically,
yeah.
In WCW. And maybe that was a call from somebody in the back thinking that people would rather watch wrestling.
We got a promo from Ric Flair cutting a promo for the WCW shop.
WCW, what the big boys wear.
Hey, this is the Nature Bar. Woo, and we are the Horsemen with the Salem War Game. Style and profile. Wear one of these great t-shirts. Hey, it's Fall Brawl. It's WCW.
Get your very own official Fall Brawl t-shirt for just $19.95. Call 1-800-WCW-8661. WCW, what the big boys wear.
Wear the big t-shirt at Fall Brawl. Woo!
What the big boys wear. For $19.95, you can buy your own Fall Brawl t-shirt.
Sold.
Holy Christ.
Yeah.
Mike Tenay is then backstage and asks if it's ironic that the savior is the one, the savior of WCW is the one who has been fined and suspended the most in WCW, Randy Savage, who proceeds to cut a promo yelling, "Stop the music." He's wearing a Nitro t-shirt, which I don't know if you could purchase for $19.95, and says he's going to hit a grand slam against the Giant, and then he's going to rip Hulk Hogan's black heart out of his chest because he has a title match with Hogan at Halloween Havoc. So we already know the main event for the next pay-per-view. It's Randy Savage going for the title. And over the next two matches, we were going to see how they could build that match. Mm-hmm. So we got Randy Savage against the Giant in our, I guess, match second from the top. Did you notice how the Giant, he comes out to the Dungeon of Doom theme? And then halfway down the aisle, it changes to the NWO theme, almost like they forgot he had joined.
Hmm.
They just switched it, like, midway through his entrance.
Maybe that's to signify his it's
either,
change.
It's either a mistake or the shittiest mix ever. Nick Patrick is the referee. At this point, he hadn't fully joined the NWO, but was doing all of these tactics to make you think that he's being paid off by the NWO. They fight in the aisle. He tries to body slam the Giant, but the Giant lands on top of Savage and then gains the advantage inside of the ring. Very, very basic offense. And remember, the Giant was like a year into his career at this point. Mm-hmm. So he was just completely learning on the fly.
Yeah, a lot of rest holds. Just very slow.
Yeah, backbreaker, chops. Savage goes for his eyes, breaks free, is going after the knee of the Giant, hits a facebuster off the top. Then scoop slams the Giant for a really big reaction, climbs to the top, hits his elbow drop right as Hulk Hogan comes to ringside. Savage goes after Hogan in the aisle and gets attacked by Hall and Nash right near the entrance. Nash hits him with a chair shot. They stomp on him, return him to the ring. Nick Patrick ignores all of this that's happening on the outside, and Dusty is demanding that Nick Patrick's license be revoked, and the Giant just pins Savage 7 minutes 46 seconds.
Yeah.
Wouldn't this make you think that the Giant should want this title shot? He's the former champion, beats the number one contender. Why is this guy part of the NWO?
Well, he needed the help of the NWO to beat him.
I see. So Savage here, a month later, would challenge for the title.
Yeah.
Coming out of this. But there will be much more of Randy Savage on this show, including the Halloween Havoc promo built around Savage, who asks such questions as, "Are you scared of things that go bump in the night? Are you afraid of things that fly in the air? Talk about trick-or-treat. Halloween Havoc."
Well,
sold me.
Did you dress up as for Halloween that year?
In 1996? Oh, I have no clue. Maybe the fake Repo Man.
The fake Repo Man?
Instead of like the fake Diesel or Razor.
Wow.
Do you remember your Halloween that year?
I'm trying to think what I dressed up as. What year would that have been?
96.
Yeah, yeah. So, 95, I think I went as like a baseball player. Because I was a big Jays fan.
Just a random baseball player, a specific one?
Whatever.
I dressed up as Kelly Gruber a few years. He was my favorite baseball player.
With a mullet?
No mullet.
I was
number 17.
You had a jersey?
Yep.
Nice.
Had the white pants.
What happened to Kelly Gruber? Why did he leave in mid-92?
It was a big scandal that he was injured, and then the Toronto Star caught photos of him like jet skiing while he was supposedly on the DL.
Ooh.
Then he got dealt to the California Angels, and I don't know where he went after that. I think he got like a coaching gig shortly thereafter.
Okay.
It was kind of just faded into obscurity. He's just retired now, I think.
Yeah, that's kind of too bad.
He was my favorite player, though.
Why did you like him?
I don't know. I just... maybe it was because with my friends, I always played third base. So he was the third baseman. And then eventually he played with them in 92. I think he was still on the roster in 93. But at that point, Ed Sprague had been moved from catcher to third.
And yeah.
Gruber, I think, was just either let go or put on waivers or something.
Ed Sprague was the first baseball player I'd ever met.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I think my dad took me to the Sky Dome for the first time. And we just like snuck our way in. We just stumbled our way in.
Into the Sky Dome?
Yeah. I don't know how.
I don't know how you got in there.
But I found myself in the field, and, like, there was some, like, I don't know, kids camp thing, charity thing, and a bunch of kids were on the field, and Ed Sprague was signing autographs, and I just wandered out there, and I got his autograph.
That's cool.
Yeah.
Do you still have it?
Snuck our way in. I think so, somewhere, probably.
I think when I was a kid, I got Sean Green's autograph.
Oh, the Canadian.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Who went on to hit, like, 40 home runs one year.
Yeah.
It was 94 when him and Carlos Delgado started, and they were like our two big prospects.
Yeah, he's Canadian, right? Am I thinking
Sean Green? I think he was.
Okay, maybe not.
I'm pretty sure he was.
Okay.
I don't know. I don't care. The cage lowers for War Games with this pyro display, and Mike Tenay is in the back with Ric Flair, Arn Anderson, and Lex Luger, and they ask who is going to replace Sting on their team. Flair just simply says the Horsemen are going to kick ass. Arn says that they have lost a friend and WCW has lost an icon, with Sting presumably joining the NWO after Monday's attack, and says they're just simply going to do this themselves. And then Sting walks in and he denies that it was him on Nitro, but Luger does not believe him. He said, "I looked into your eyes on Monday and I don't believe you, Sting." Like, what an idiot babyface he would turn out to be. But this was the whole emphasis of why Sting would go to the Crow Sting, because WCW doubted him from all his years of loyalty.
That's right.
So this was at least setting something up big.
They had the way they shot Sting here. Sting had his back to the camera as he was confronting Luger and Flair, and you know, I thought that was a good detail. They didn't want to show, obviously, you know, too much of the face. It really surprises me how often pro wrestling has tried to do the, you know, fake such and such angle, especially in the mid 90s, in this span, you know. We had the fake Undertaker, of course, and then here we had the fake Sting, and we also
next
get the
fake Diesel,
fake
and,
Diesel
Razor.
And Razor. And Jesus, it's just like, how stupid were we? You know? All they did was like pick a guy of a similar build and height and just, you know, put the same some
put
makeup
paint
on. And, I mean, as a kid, I kind of fell for it. I don't know if, you know, in our HD world, this would necessarily work, though.
Yeah, it was...
Masks are fine, but, like, when it's, like, just face paint, it's... I don't know.
Michael Buffer reads off the rules. The NWO has only released 3 of the 4 names. The other one will be a surprise. And it's unknown if WCW will even have 4 members. And we should also mention, this is in North Carolina, so this was one of the big staples for the Horsemen. And here are the Horsemen going after the NWO. So you had, and you had a very good attendance here and a gate for this particular War Games built around this match. So the War Games match starts off with Scott Hall and Arn Anderson. They go through a 5-minute period. The crowd was really into Arn whenever he got on offense and went after the knee of Hall.
He's a lot of fun to watch wrestle, and I still, you know, I mean, he's very much respected, but I still feel like, you know, in the shadow of like a Ric Flair, he's still very kind of underappreciated, but just a really great, tight, aggressive, technical, old school style that, you know, was on perfect display in a match like this.
Schiavone announces that the NWO has won the coin toss, therefore they will have the numbers advantage throughout the match. So out third was Kevin Nash, and they start double-teaming Arn and get the advantage. And now it will be every, did they say every 30 seconds a new member would come in, I think?
I don't remember.
Whatever. Or every 2 minutes, maybe, I think, was it. Lex Luger is out next. He comes out early. The announcers just say, that's okay, it's war. That was their explanation. It's okay, it's war. Luger evens it up, driving Hall into the cage. Hogan is out fifth, and Luger and Arn are double-teaming Hogan to a huge reaction, and the crowd is chanting, we want Flair. The NWO gets the advantage. Hogan hits a leg drop to Arn, and then Ric Flair comes out, and him and Hogan get isolated into one ring. Crowd is going nuts here as Flair attacks Hogan with punches, hits Nash and Hall with low blows, and then applies a figure four onto Hogan. The seventh member in was the final member for the NWO team, and it was the fake Sting. So the announcers believe this is the real Sting.
They were convinced.
You know, It's him.
They were convinced because he pulled off a Stinger splash.
Yes. Like, one of your number one rules for babyfaces and for a babyface announcer as well is that you should never have the audience believe that they know more than the baby. Like, they're outsmarting the babyface. The babyface should always be able to outsmart the heel at the end of the day.
Okay. I'm a little confused.
Sorry. I'm saying, like, the announcers are out and they're just believing this is the real Sting.
Yeah.
And the audience member at home, I think, is saying to themselves, bullshit, that's not the real Sting.
Right.
I think it just makes you, it takes you out of having any confidence.
I thought they over-exaggerated, you know, their believability. Like, I mean, I thought their reactions were, and I think that, you know, the WCW announced team has been guilty of exaggerating in the past, and I thought this was no different. It was just, they went a little too over the top trying to convince us that this was, you know, the real Sting.
Yeah, this was Jeff Farmer, for those curious, who would have a lengthy run over in Japan with New Japan and the NWO Japan contingent. Just pretty much doing all of Sting's trademark spots and, yes, the Stinger splashes, which were pretty much DNA evidence.
Yeah. The cameras were also, they also made sure to keep the angles nice and wide. So
yes, no close-ups of the face.
No.
Out number,
but the crowd definitely, you know, knew something was up.
They were silent here as they were watching this guy attack the Horseman and Luger. And then the final member comes out, and it's the real Sting. And he goes after the fake version to a monstrous reaction. He lays out everyone and then asks multiple times so they catch it on camera, is that good enough for you? Mm-hmm. And he leaves the cage and abandons the team and goes to the back. And then Hogan proceeds to leg drop Luger. The fake Sting then puts Luger into the Scorpion Deathlock while Hogan applies some kind of front face lock that was so debilitating that it put Lex Luger out cold as Nick Patrick calls for the bell at 18 minutes and 22 seconds.
It was a Darce choke.
The Hogan Darce choke.
Yeah, he invented it.
And Schiavone just says, if we had trusted Sting, we would have won. And he just responds, shut up. Just shut up, Tony. Shut up.
Well, when the real Sting arrived, the announcers saw the elevation of his Stinger splash. So they're thus even more convinced.
Wait a minute. There's two Stings. What's going on? And they explain that Luger passed out. He did not give up. And they're attacking him on the aisle. They brawl in the aisle. Savage comes out to attack Hogan to a big reaction. And the Giant comes up from behind and attacks Savage. To which Bobby Heenan notes, the NWO has outsmarted us all year. The Giant then chokeslams Randy Savage. Elizabeth comes out to hover on top of Savage to get the NWO to stop this attack. And this leads to Hogan spray painting Elizabeth's dress. And Heenan calls Hogan the lowest level of life he has ever seen. The crowd is chanting, Hogan sucks. Hogan gets on the mic calling them pieces of trash and spits on Elizabeth. Schiavone calls this the lowest point in WCW history, which, Jesus Christ, Tony, fast forward a couple of years. And then Hogan spits right into the camera. Giant chokeslam Savage again. The NWO storms the announce desk, and they cut more promos. They hold up an NWO country sign, and they sign off stating they want their demands honored, and Savage is with Elizabeth and is being helped to the back as the show goes off the air. It's complete anarchy with Savage destroyed, the Horseman destroyed, Lex Luger destroyed, and Sting just saying, fuck you all.
Mm-hmm.
That was the context of how WCW, the state they were in at the end of Fall Brawl in 1996.
It's very depressing. Well, the wrestling was what it was, but I thought it was a very hot match because the feud was so hot. You know, the NWO was still, you know, in its relative infancy at the time, and I felt like a War Games setting was really the perfect setting for a faction war of this sort. And, you know, I thought the booking was done pretty well. I thought all the entrances were pretty well paced. The Sting stuff, as hokey as it looks today, I thought it seemed to really work at this point.
It was a tangible reason for this major shift in the character, who feels he had been doubted by this company he'd been totally loyal for, and it was going to set up the biggest storyline during WWE's peak period.
And even as fake as the fake Sting looked, when the real Sting finally appeared, this crowd just kind of went ballistic. So I thought, like you said, in terms of draw, this was definitely a one-match show, and I thought the main event delivered.
Yeah, you can look at this point, and certainly this was, as WWE was really heating up, and I totally get the argument that you've got to create this chaos for the NWO and really heat them up into this destructible force. At the same time, and this has been a criticism, was that, man, they destroyed their baby faces during this time. Mm-hmm. And with Sting kind of taken out of the picture, I mean, look at the Horsemen, you pretty much decapitated in front of their home audience in North Carolina. And Savage was just beaten to a pulp on this show. You didn't really have that strong babyface figure to oppose them while Sting was on the sidelines.
No, not until Goldberg did you really have that.
No, it was, I mean, Luger, they would get to a certain level. I mean, the Giant would flip back, but it was not really until Sting came back and then later Goldberg that you had those big baby faces. And even them, they really fumbled the ball with them as top baby faces and getting that big win at the end of the day over the NWO, which really never happened. So there you go. That was Fall Brawl 96. I'm going to give this show a 6.5 out of 10. There was some really good wrestling on this show. And it was at a time when, I mean, interest in WCW was just shooting through the roof. It was very fresh with the NWO, with Hogan's turn at the time. And you got some great wrestling underneath. Whether the crowd was into it or not, it was some great wrestling. I mean, the main events, I mean, these were not the top-level talents, but these characters were really over.
Yeah, I mean, I give it a 6. You know, it seems a little harsh kind of thinking back and seeing, oh, there's a Benoit Jericho match here, there's a Rey Mysterio match here, but I just couldn't help but, like, feel the show drag a little, maybe largely due to, you know, the energy from the crowd, or just, I don't know, maybe just kind of having seen a lot of these guys before, but that's how I feel.
All right, we're going to go to the feedback right now. First one is from Painkiller. War Games, WCW's bastard child and Hell in a Cell's bastard stepbrother. Heenan said it right towards the end. They've outsmarted us all year. Shame that WCW never learned its lesson about booking stupid baby faces.
Brad from Whitby, September of 96 was an important month for both John and I. The Nintendo 64 was released on September the 29th, my birthday. To upgrade, my brother and I sold our Super Nintendo along with all of our games, a decision I regret to this very day. Here are some random thoughts about Fall Brawl. The undercard of the show was great. Loved the most of the matches before the Giant Savage match. Words Dusty can't pronounce. Ventriloquist and ramifications.
They are tough.
There are way too many annoying people in the crowd trying to get on TV. This audience really made me respect the JCW crowd from a couple weeks ago. I would like to apologize to all the juggalos for my harsh words. I assume both of you guys watched John's VHS, but I watched this on the network and I noticed something interesting that maybe others saw too. The video tracking bar had some circles on it, showing you where the start and finish of every match was for easier navigation. All of them except Benoit and Jericho. Why include the match but not this feature?
Ooh, what a conspiracy.
I noticed that too. What?
So you can't. So it's got it divided into like chapters on the navigation bar, but yeah, it doesn't state where the Benoit Jericho match begins.
Yeah,
that's weird.
But I mean, I mean, I like to know if that's the case for all of Benoit, appearances, because it can't be.
That seems like a ridiculous measure to take.
Yeah. Finally, he says, I fear to ask one more fifth anniversary question, but I'm interested to know if you guys check every week to see how many downloads the podcast gets. I always listen to the show from the Poboard site, but I know the show goes up on iTunes as well. Maybe it's harder to track through multiple distributors. We can't, unfortunately, track how many iTunes subscribers we even have. iTunes just doesn't offer that information. I mean,
for anybody.
So, you know, I'd like to hear suggestions if people have ways that they can track. We can track how many people visit the fightnetwork.com to download directly. But we know that those are like only a portion of the download, so we don't even know how much our total is. It's kind of hard to tell, unfortunately.
And Chris in Ottawa. All right, a WCW show from its peak period. I vividly remember watching the main event in Scramble Vision back when Viewer's Choice was my favorite makeshift radio station. The main event signified Sting's launch into becoming the most compelling figure in pro wrestling for the next year. Even friends of mine that derided wrestling as stupid before this pay-per-view were softened by the NWO and then became regular viewers with the beginning of this terrific angle. My favorite part of the show, like most big WCW events, was the credits. The wrestling operations team was Arn Anderson, credited as Marty Lund, Janie Engel, who was Eric Bischoff's personal assistant and would jump to the WWF in 1998, and the original assassin Jody Hamilton, and Tony Schiavone's wife Jennifer did post-production. But despite that awesome credit roll, the hard work by much of the undercard, and the continuing success of WCW's primary story, this show unfortunately scores a 0 out of 10 by default, as WWE Network refused to clear the song that ushered alternative rock into the mainstream, DDP's Self High Five.
Huh.
Wow, what an unfortunate missing part of WCW history to not have on the network.
What do you think they replaced it with?
I don't know. I watched this on...
Oh, it must have been his WWF theme.
Perhaps, yeah. I didn't watch the network version, so I can't even tell you what's on there. It's probably just a random track. All right, well, thank you, folks, for those of you that went out and checked out Fall Brawl 1996.
Next week.
Way, you have had some time now. You have had an hour and 15 minutes to decide what you want to review next week. We will review anything.
I haven't put any thought into it, but hey, do you want to watch some of the Monday Night War episodes on the network?
We can.
Is that worth reviewing? That's a no.
Not really.
Okay. How about Wrestling Society X?
Sure.
Featuring Seth Rollins, Vampiro, Teddy Hart, Ricky Banderas, and more.
I think we actually have that. I think they sent me the whole first season of Wrestling Society X. So we do have it. Okay. I don't know how easy it'll be for others to see it, but I'm sure you can take a gander online and see what is out there of Wrestling Society X. How many episodes are we going to review?
How long are they?
I want to say they were an hour, weren't they?
I have no clue.
Let's find this out.
Wrestling Society X.
Dude, the episodes are 20 minutes each. They must have been in 30-minute slots with commercials. Well, they have...
We could do, like, three?
Three episodes?
Yeah.
They have the first three up here. Okay.
Is it just the first three?
No, they're all there.
Okay. I mean, we could do more than that. We don't have to do the first three. We could just, like, kind of jump around. How many episodes were there? Let's do the first one. Let's do one in the middle, and then let's do one at the end. They're actually all on YouTube.
Okay. Well... which ones do you want to watch?
All right.
Episode one.
Let's do one. Five.
And
the last one, which is... actually, one of them was unaired, so... Okay, let's do one, five, and nine.
One, five, and nine? Okay.
Is that confusing?
No.
One, five... Nine.
All right. So next week on the show, we're gonna review episodes number 1, 5, and 9 of Wrestling Society X. So we will get a little bit of the entire first season of Wrestling Society X.
Yeah.
All right. These are pretty easy to find. You can go to MTV.com. All the episodes are also up on YouTube, so they will be easy to find, and we'll post them as well when we put up the feedback thread. I remember when these first aired in 2007, and any wrestlers that were a part of this project rave about it because they were treated like gold. It was like a full-on MTV production, got catering. It was a great deal, yeah.
Wow.
So we will check those out. Episodes 1, 5, and 9 of Wrestling Society X coming up next week on Review Away. On The Law this Sunday night, midnight Eastern, we'll be chatting Night of Champions. And speaking of champions, we'll be joined by IWGP champion AJ Styles on the program. So that is all coming up. And you can go to liveaudiowrestling.com, subscribe on iTunes, Stitcher, Fight Network app. And to get us out of here, Way, is there a particular song, perhaps inspired by either Fall Brawl or MTV's Wrestling Society X, that can properly end off this show?
No. What are you listening to lately?
Nothing.
You've got to be listening to something.
I think.
What was the last song you heard in completion? The last full song you listened to?
You know what? It was probably one of those damn U2 songs that got put onto my phone. Did you get the fucking album?
No.
You didn't get it automatically downloaded?
No, I've heard this happen.
Go into your music folder.
Well, I don't think my phone automatically downloads.
A lot of them did.
I mean, I turned it off. I turn off automatic downloads, but what happened? I don't think U2's on my phone, or U2's in my phone. No, I don't think I...
On albums? It's not there?
No.
Wow. Well, my phone...
What's it called?
Songs of Innocence.
It automatically downloaded?
Yeah.
Onto your phone?
That drove me nuts.
What an invasion of privacy.
You're not joking. Like, to me, this is a slippery slope. It's like, what else can they now just put onto my phone?
This is like terrorism.
Like, am I going to just get multiple albums? It costs them $100 million to put out this free album.
Well, it costs you bandwidth, first of all. But it
absolutely.
It also, like...
I don't want this on my phone.
Exactly. Like, it just... You know, it's you too. Who would want it on their phone?
Well, because I was forced to have to endure this album being
put on me. Now you're going to terrorize our audience?
Yeah, we're going to hear.
Music?
We're going to hear from one. Give me a number between 1 and 11 for what track we're going to play going out here.
How about number 9?
All right, well.
You haven't deleted it yet. It's still on your phone.
No, I haven't. But they're all going to leave, starting with track number 9, because I hope this album sleeps like a baby tonight. We're not playing this whole thing. It's way too long. In the colors of forgiveness.
Gotta take the universe and turn it upside down. Let it happen. Isn't it ironic? Yeah, you're right. Couldn't be more right that I, the evil necessity of the WCW, comes to the plate and guaranteed I'm gonna hit a grand slam against the giant. Oh, yeah!